This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The current movie, The Virgin Suicides, is based on the novel of the same name. My guest is the author of the book, Jeffrey Eugenides. The New Yorker included him in its list of the 20 best American writers for the 21st century. We invited Eugenides to join us from the BBC studio in Berlin, where he's now living on a fellowship. Let's start with a reading from The Virgin Suicides, which was first published in 1993. The story is told in the collective voice of several men remembering back to their adolescence in the 70s, when they lived in a wealthy suburb of Detroit and became obsessed with five sisters in the neighborhood, the Lisbon Girls. Each of the Lisbon Girls committed suicide, and the reasons remain a mystery. In an attempt to understand the suicides, the novel becomes a reverie about the mysteries and unknowability of the world of teenaged girls.
On the morning the last Lisbon daughter took her turn at suicide, it was Mary this time, and sleeping pills, like Therese. The two paramedics arrived at the house knowing exactly where the knife drawer was, and the gas oven, and the beam in the basement from which it was possible to tie a rope. They got out of the EMS truck, as usual, moving much too slowly, in our opinion. And the fat one said under his breath, "This ain't TV, folks. This is how fast we go." He was carrying the heavy respirator and cardiac unit past the bushes that had grown monstrous and over the erupting lawn, tame and immaculate 13 months earlier, when the trouble began. Cecilia, the youngest, only 13, had gone first, slitting her wrists like a stoic while taking a bath. And when they found her afloat in her pink pool, with the yellow eyes of someone possessed and her small body giving off the odor of a mature woman, the paramedics had been so frightened by her tranquility that they had stood mesmerized. But then Mrs. Lisbon lunged in, screaming, and the reality of the room reasserted itself. Blood on the bath mat, Mr. Lisbon's razor sunk in the toilet bowl, marbling the water. The paramedics fetched Cecilia out of the warm water because it quickened the bleeding and put a tourniquet on her arm. Her wet hair hung down her back, and already her extremities were blue. She didn't say a word, but when they parted her hands, they found the laminated picture of the Virgin Mary she held against her budding chest.
That's Jeffrey Eugenides reading from his novel, The Virgin Suicides. Jeffrey, what was the germ of the idea of five sisters who all commit suicide?
It was a story told to me by my nephew's babysitter almost 10 years ago now. I was back in Detroit visiting my brother and got to talking to the babysitter that he and his wife had. And she was, I think, about 15 or 16. And I only met her for about 15 minutes, and within that span of time, she somehow told me that she and all her sisters had attempted suicide. And I was obviously shocked by that, and I asked her why, and she couldn't tell me why. She just said that she was under a lot of pressure. And then she disappeared, and she never worked for my brother again, and I was left with that that exchange and that mystery. And it lingered in my mind after that. But it was probably over a year or two before I began the novel. And I had the idea of a quintuple suicide in my mind, but I didn't know how to tell the story. And then at a certain point, I got the idea to tell the story with a collective narrator. And once I had the voice of the novel and the plot or the story, then I started writing it.
The collective narrator, that's the voice of the boys who fantasize about these five sisters and find them very kind of sexual and mysterious in the way that young teenage boys find young teenage girls. Their suicides, the girls' suicides, is a great mystery to these boys, and it's a mystery they never quite solved. Do you feel like you solved it?
No, I didn't. I mean, the book is really about the survivors of suicide more than the victims of suicide, and I've known a few people in my own life who've committed suicide and have been always left with a lot of questions in the same way, and that's my experience with suicide. So that's how I dealt with it in the book. I tried to give a lot of different possible reasons, including the narrative voice, showing why the girls might have done it. But I never thought that with anyone that I've known who's committed suicide, you could point to one exact reason.
Did you know a lot of people who committed suicide?
I knew two people who committed suicide, and the one that stuck in my mind most was a guy I went to college with who came over to my house the day before, and we got to talking about Zen for some reason, and he wanted to know what I knew about Zen, and you know, I sensed that he was very eager and a little bit manic to find out some solution to his problems in his life, but I never realized he was that depressed, and he actually borrowed a book from me on Zen and went home, and the next day he killed himself.
What questions did that raise for you? Did you wonder, like, if your conversation put him over the edge or anything?
No, I mean, I could see that, I mean, that was the kind of experience that made me realize that you know, how limited is our understanding of other people's consciousness and the extent of their suffering, really, because he wasn't, nothing we talked about was remotely connected to suicide.
To the boys who narrate The Virgin Suicides, the world of teenage girls is very exotic, very out of reach, and kind of forbidden. And there's a short passage that I think really sums up how exotic the teenage girls' world appears to the boys. And this is a sentence that has to do with, you know, they're telling the story of how one of the boys was over at the girl's house, one of the few boys ever to go over to the girl's house. And he needed the bathroom, and I think the downstairs bathroom was taken, so he had to go upstairs to the girl's bathroom.
Right.
One of the sisters' bathroom. Would you read the sentence?
Sure. He came back to us with stories of bedrooms filled with crumpled panties, of stuffed animals hugged to death by the passion of the girls, of a crucifix draped with a brassiere, of gauzy chambers, of canopied beds, and of the effluvia of so many young girls becoming women together in the same cramped space.
Do you remember that era of your life, and did teenage girls seem really exotic and
yes,
very sexual and very forbidden?
I obviously remember it. People, sometimes having read the book, ask me, you must have had sisters, but actually the truth is that I only had brothers, and for that reason, a house with even one girl was always an exotic place for me, and when I was ever in a house with three or four, it was only multiplied, and I did feel that way. I mean, the bedrooms, the conduct of the parents, and the paraphernalia in a house with girls in it was so alien to me, and I would sort of pay attention and examine it as though I were on a sort of archaeological dig or something.
What did you find most exotic or arousing about the idea of a girl's bedroom or bathroom?
The amount of clothes and products, and usually the sort of slovenliness of the girls that I knew at that time, the amount of sweaters on the floor, the amount of nail polish and spilled drinks and everything that they would have. And I had a sort of neat little boy's bedroom at home, so it always seemed like very much full of life when I would go to other bedrooms of girls that I knew at the time.
The girls' diaries are eventually published, as I recall, and the boys read their diaries. And in one of the paragraphs they say, because of reading the diaries, we knew the pain of winter wind rushing up your skirt and the ache of keeping your knees together in class and how drab and infuriating it was to jump rope while the boys played baseball. We could never understand why the girls cared so much about being mature or why they felt compelled to compliment each other. But sometimes after one of us had read a long portion of the diary out loud, we had to fight back the urge to hug one another or tell each other how pretty we were. That's a really good and also really funny passage that, you know, is it kind of gets at their attempts at empathy and what they could and couldn't relate to. Would you talk about writing that?
Well, I just tried to think of being, you know, I tried to remember when I was in sixth grade or something, and I would see the girls sort of cordoned off in a different world than we were in. We played a game called Kill the Man with the Ball on a gravel schoolyard lot, and we would just sort of maul each other, and then across the way, all the girls would be jumping rope. I just remembered that sort of partitioning in so many of the things in the early 60s, and I mean in the late 60s and early 70s when I was growing up. So, I don't know what to say about... I didn't write it thinking to highlight any of the things that came out. I just tried to stay true to how I remembered feeling at the time.
Have you often found yourself wondering what girls find to be exotic about boys or appealing about boys as young teens?
I understood much later what girls liked about teenage boys. I was under the mistaken impression for a long time that what they liked was someone like them, someone perhaps more sensitive and talkative and someone who reads books and things like that. But I actually found that they, as boys, are sometimes attracted by the opposite. Girls seem to be also attracted by the opposite.
Which kind of boy were you?
I was the mistakenly sensitive one.
Who read books.
Yeah.
My guest is Jeffrey Eugenides, author of the novel The Virgin Suicides, which is the basis of the current film. Let's hear the scene we were just talking about. This scene has a couple of shifts in time and point of view. It begins with the boys reading from Cecilia's diary, which the plumber found after her first suicide attempt. Then the reading continues as we hear the voice of Cecilia reading an entry about her sister Lux. The scene ends with some reflections from the film's narrator, played by actor Giovanni Ribisi.
Today we went out on the boat. It was pretty cold. We saw a couple of whales. Lux leaned over and stroked the whale. I didn't think they would stink so much. It's the kelp in their baleens rotting. I hope we can go again sometime. And look, history's actually that. Lux lost it over Kevin...
Hines.
Is it Hines?
The garbage man.
The garbage man.
Lux lost it over Kevin Haynes, the garbage man. She'd wake up at 5 in the morning and hang out casually on the front steps, like it wasn't completely obvious. She wrote his name and marker on all her bras and underwear, and Mom found them and bleached out all the Kevins. Lux was crying on her bed all day.
And so we started to learn about their lives. Coming to hold collective memories of times we hadn't experienced, we felt the imprisonment of being a girl. The way it made your mind active and dreamy, and how you ended up knowing what colors went together. We knew that the girls were really women in disguise, that they understood love and even death, and that our job was merely to create the noise that seemed to fascinate them. We knew that they knew everything about us, and that we couldn't fathom them at all.
When the first girl attempts suicide in your novel and survives, she's taken to a psychiatrist, and he says, "What are you doing here, honey? You're not even old enough to know how bad life gets." And she answers, "Obviously, doctor, you've never been a 13-year-old girl." Now, Sofia Coppola, who made the film adaptation of your novel, said that that's the line that really made her want to do the movie, because she'd been a 13-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering your reaction to her reaction to that passage.
You know, the line is somewhat comic to me, and I was just glad that it struck a chord in her or in anyone else. Certainly, that's a line that has been repeated back to me quite often from women.
Now you obviously have never been a 13-year-old girl yourself, but you're not writing from the perspective of a 13-year-old girl. You're writing from the perspective of the boys who are interested in these young girls. I think the movie adaptation tells the story a little bit from the perspective of the girls, too, because we're often alone with them in their rooms, mm-hmm. or alone with them in their scenes in the way that we're not in the novel, because it is always from the boys' point of
right.
view. And I'm wondering what you think of that shift, that slight shift of perspective in the movie. I assume that you've seen it.
I have seen it. I knew that the point of view in the movie would necessarily be more from the girls than the boys. I mean, it's very clear in the book that it's always... anything they know about the girls is mediated through another source, and so therefore suspect. And the reader knows that what the boys are telling the reader might not be exactly the truth. When in a movie, when you have the girls in a scene and they're real live girls, and Kirsten Dunst is up on the screen, the audience can only believe this as actually the truth. Sophia was fairly scrupulous in tipping the audience off, you know, so that we know that the boys are watching all the time. But it's impossible to keep that in your mind, and the movie doesn't remind the audience of the reader as often as the book does. So that was something I knew would happen. I also felt that Sophia saw the book more from the girl's point of view because of her identification with the 13-year-old girl. And I've noticed in readers in general, the women will read the book and sort of see it from the girl's side, and boys will read it and see it from the boy's side.
There's a character and something he does that I want to ask you about. There's a character named Trip Fontaine, who's the handsome teen that all the girls have a crush on, and he takes one of the sisters to the homecoming. They have sex on the football field after the homecoming party. And when she falls asleep, he leaves. He walks out on her, and she has to take a cab home alone. He later says, "I liked her. I really liked her. I just got sick of her right then." Would you explain that for us? I think that's probably really getting to something that's really mysterious to girls and women about about boys.
Well, that is something I've heard similar things from friends, and not that many, but looking at his character, thinking about how Trip Fontaine had grown up, I felt that would be his reaction at that time. I don't think it's pandemic in men to act that way, actually. I just thought that in that situation with those characters, that's what would have happened.
Why? Because he's self-absorbed or no empathy? Maybe you just intuitively knew that that's how he would behave.
Well, a lot of the decisions in the book are just taken from things I'd witnessed. So I sort of don't have to always know the reason why someone acted that way. I just remember that in such a situation, this person did react that way. And it's more reporting. I mean, this book is not a psychological book in terms of going into the different people's heads. So I'm not sure that I can answer that. I think you would come up with the kind of trivialities about not being able to connect or the problem with his mother leaving him that I actually wouldn't want to indulge in.
You grew up in Grosse Pointe, Michigan, which is a suburb of Detroit. I believe that's a very affluent.
It is.
Suburb of Detroit.
I was born in Detroit, and then we moved to Grosse Pointe.
And the novel is set in a similar suburban setting.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the things that you remember about growing up in a suburb that you wanted to put into the novel?
The biggest thing, I think, about where I grew up and how it affected the book was that in Detroit, obviously going through the riots in 1967, I saw the city sort of be destroyed, and my experience of growing up was with things coming apart and falling apart, and it imbued my childhood with a sense of elegy and a sense of entropy that I think is really the basic spirit of the Virgin Suicides. When I really think, why did I write this book, I think it comes from growing up in a city and at a time, even in America, where things seem to be getting worse and falling apart, and society and the economy. And, you know, in my life, anytime we would get in the car and drive, we would see burned out houses and burned out streets. The bar that my grandfather owned was burned down, and that it was like not exactly growing up in Beirut, but it had that kind of feeling. And I think those atmospherics are really central to the book, and actually central to my inspiration for writing it.
Since was it your grandfather's bar, did you say, that was burned down?
My grandfather's bar, yeah.
Did that mean that you took the riots kind of personally, as like a personal condemnation?
No. It wasn't burned. His bar was burned down later. It wasn't burned down during the riots, but the neighborhood was sort of hurt by the riots and got worse and worse. And finally, like many things in Detroit, his bar was burned.
What was it like to live surrounded by prosperity after that?
It's a very strange way to grow up. It's almost an experience like a South African upbringing or something like that. Incredible racial divide. I've never experienced a racial divide like Detroit's. you just the enmity and the misunderstanding in a place like that affects you very strongly. I went to a prep school, so it was actually the only school where there were black students, and otherwise in Grosse Pointe, in the public schools, there weren't any black students at all.
In a review that you wrote of Tom Wolfe's novel, A Man in Full, you described yourself as a guy who spends all day in his room. But when you were young, you must have traveled a lot, because I know you traveled through Egypt, you worked with Mother Teresa.
Yeah, I took a year off in college and traveled around the world for 9 months on $3,500. And it was a great experience. And yeah, I lived four months in India and did work for a short time with Mother Teresa, and went as far as Thailand and went all through Europe and went to North Africa.
How did you get involved with Mother Teresa, and what kind of work did you do with her?
I worked at the Home for the Destitute and Dying, which is sort of her flagship operation, where people are brought in close to death and usually do die, sometimes recover. And a lot of people work there in the morning. European and American and Australian volunteers can come in for 3 or 4 hours and work, and the rest of the time the sisters run the place. And I didn't work there that long, and I have something half written about it, about that experience, but I found that I was not exactly capable of becoming a missionary. It was sort of a turning point in my life where I realized my vocation for writing and not my vocation for that sort of commitment.
What made you realize that?
Well, some sort of lowly parts of my character, which I've had to embrace, but the fact that I actually couldn't get along or didn't enjoy being with the other people who worked at Mother Teresa's, I found them, as you might imagine, sometimes really lacking in any sense of humor. They were sometimes were very good, but sort of good in a dull way. And I just felt, I don't mean to condemn them, but I just felt so different than them. I felt that anything that was, was admirable about me just wasn't the same kind of thing that was admirable about them. And I just saw that it wasn't really my place to be. And at the same time, I was staying at the Salvation Army in Calcutta, and hanging out with sort of some crazy Germans who had been traveling for 17 years, and I found them so interesting, and their openness of mind just appealed to me so much more that it just seemed to come down in my life as a choosing between two paths or something, and I chose the other one.
Did you meet Mother Teresa, and did you think of her as a saint?
I met her briefly and saw her occasionally, and because she's called a saint, I guess when you're so prepared to think of her as a saint, I don't. My religious background wasn't sufficient that I actually believed in actual sainthood or in magical properties in a person, but obviously, I knew that's Mother Teresa, and watched her every move. The strange thing is that when I saw her, who she reminded me of was George Burns, the comedian, because she was just sort of hunched over and had a slightly humorous sort of aura about her. Not that she was being funny, but there was just something that made you sort of smile, and I mean, you just put the cigar in her hand, it would have been complete.
She was really an old vaudevillian, wasn't she?
I thought so. I thought perhaps she'd missed her. She'd taken the wrong path.
Was it at all a spiritual experience, and did you try to impose a spirituality on it if it didn't feel spiritual, feeling like it was supposed to feel spiritual?
I tried to impose a spirituality on it. The short story I'm writing about it will hopefully explain all this better than I can in speech, but I was in a way I was 20. I mean, if you ever read William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, there's a long passage about people in late adolescence, which is what I still felt I was at around 20, and that they have enough ego to make sort of very strict decisions about themselves, and yet their ego is still unformed and sort of cloud-like, and they feel affinity for sort of mystical states. And I think that describes me pretty well. I was sort of putting on another persona and trying to live a life to see whether I could do it. And I was very mystically minded in that time. And you know, I wouldn't take it back. It was one of the greatest periods of my life, and I think perhaps the happiest. But in some ways, it was a little bit of a theater piece, sort of acting the missionary and trying to see if I could change my life completely. And I had certain models in my mind, like Thomas Merton or people like that, sort of literary religious saints or converts, people who had really changed their lives radically. And I wanted that sort of thing. I think in many ways I wanted to escape my body or my physical existence because of all of the sort of difficulties one has with passion and with dating and with all of that sort of thing when you're 20. And I think part of that sort of inspired me to sort of move up from my lower chakras into my upper chakra and sort of turn to vapor and come out my head. You know, that's right. Sort of what I wanted.
Right.
And I got over it.
Right. Can't deal with it, transcend it.
Right.
I'm wondering how your parents felt about this, and I'm going to go back to the virgin suicides and quote a line here. When a daughter is found dead after she commits suicide with a picture of the Virgin Mary in her hands, her father later says, "We baptized her, we confirmed her, and now she believes this crap." Do you think your parents might have had a slightly similar reaction when you were out working with Mother Teresa?
My parents at the time were not very religious. My father was never religious, and I didn't have a very religious upbringing. My family was, extremely alarmed at my behavior during the Mother Teresa years. In playing out this role and trying to see how it fit, I certainly wrote letters home that were ecstatic and troubling to my mother and to my brothers. And you know, to me, it was just more fiction writing. What I was really doing was writing fiction, but they didn't understand that. They just saw that it was a letter home. I was out of contact with them, and they didn't know what was happening to me. And I have written a short story, actually, that deals with that experience called Airmail, which is about a young guy in Thailand who is very sick with amoebic dysentery, who's writing letters home and letters to everyone that he knows about his spiritual adventure that he's going on. And he's half enlightened and half cracked. And I, again, took my own life and exaggerated it beyond what I went through. I was actually not quite around the bend. My parents were. The strange thing is after that, my brother became a born-again Christian and my mother became religious. And now they're sort of the fanatics in the family. I'm sort of the secular one again.
Granta, the literary magazine,
mm-hmm.
last year named you one of the best young American novelists. The New Yorker, at the end of 1999, put you on a list of the best writers of the 21st century, a snapshot of a generation on the eve of the next century. And I believe you're about to turn 40?
I am 40 now.
You are 40.
Yeah.
So you're officially not a young writer anymore.
Yeah, I'm officially no longer qualified to be in those lists.
Exactly. Did that feel like you were crossing a threshold, or just a kind of unimportant imaginary threshold?
That affected my life more than having the book made into a movie. Turning 40, you suddenly realize that you're no longer a young writer. I was happy to see that George Eliot wrote Middlemarch at 50, though. So you're always sort of looking ahead to the older people to give yourself, make yourself feel a little bit better about the future.
What's the difference in feeling like you're officially a young writer, and then feeling you're no longer officially a young writer?
Well, from my friends who have jumped the Great Divide already, they actually tell me that it's sort of a relief because you don't have to worry about these kinds of groupings. I think once you're 40, you feel like you must know what you're doing, whereas maybe in your 20s and 30s, you're a little happier to be at sea. Writing books is always, you know, makes one feel always that you're a little bit at sea. So it's probably a little bit more difficult in your 40s to carry on and not feel, you know, you not feel that you don't have all the answers. But on the other hand, it's having a child and turning 40 is a sort of it's a great disciplining force in my life, and I find that for the first time in my life, I get up extremely early and start working instead of dawdling over my coffee and things like that. So I actually have found it beneficial to become old.
Or older, anyway.
Yeah.
I think there's a special attitude toward young writers now. Like, thank God there are some, because the belief is that few young people are interested in reading, let alone writing. Did you feel that there was this special sense of gratitude to young writers?
I don't think so. I was just reading the article about Philip Roth in The New Yorker, where he's saying every year 70 writers die and only two are replaced. And he says, you know, you can look at it, it's the continuation of the screen, from the movie screen to the television screen to the computer screen. But I grew up with the television screen and now the computer screen, and nothing, you know, I don't find anything in my life as rewarding as reading. So I'm not quite as pessimistic as he is about young people reading. And I get a lot of mail from young readers, and I don't sense that strongly, and I don't think anyone at the New Yorker or Grant have felt that either, that I could tell.
You're living in Germany now. What brought you there?
I'm here on a fellowship from the German, it's sort of the German Foreign Exchange program, and they have a smaller program within that called the Berliner Künstlerprogramm, and that brings artists and writers and composers from all over the world to live in Berlin. It's sort of a vestige from the time that the wall was up, to show free expression and artistic creativity inside West Berlin, but it's survived, fortunately, the walls coming down.
What's it like for you to be in a country where your first language isn't always understood and you're a writer functioning with diminished language abilities?
It hasn't affected my writing at all, because I'm spend most of my time as is true, as I said in the article, in my room. So most of the day is spent with English in my head, and then when I go out to speak German or attempt my German at night, it's fine. I actually have enjoyed learning another language, and people ask me, is it messing with your writing? But it hasn't at all. My German's not good enough to get into my brain that deeply at this point. I don't know if there comes a point where you start dreaming it and then you can't use English syntax, but I don't think that would happen.
Has living in Germany been affecting what you read, what you choose to read?
Mm-hmm. Not too much so far, except that I know a lot about, I read the German papers, so I know a lot more about German politics and strikes and things like that than I ever did.
So when did you come back to the States?
That's open-ended. We like it here, and we have no other house, my wife and I, Karen. And Berlin is actually a pretty good city if you have a small child, which we do. So we're staying another year, and we'll see how long we stay.
Well, good luck there.
It's more affordable than New York, so.
Uh-huh. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Eugenides is the author of The Virgin Suicides, which has been adapted into a film. He spoke to us from the BBC studio in Berlin.